The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. For a crime he did not commit, Albert Wood Fox spent more than four decades in solitary confinement in Louisiana's notoriously brutal Angola prison, 23 hours a day in a 6-by-9-foot cell. His book is a stunning indictment of a judicial system not concerned with innocence or justice, and a crushing account of the inhumanity of solitary confinement. He writes that he turned what was supposed to be a confined space of destruction and punishment into something positive. I used that space to educate myself. I used that space to build strong moral character. I used that space to develop principles and a code of conduct. I used that space for everything other than what my captors intended it to be. Sustained by the shared solidarity of two fellow prisoners, he turned his anger into activism and resistance. The Angola Three, as they became known, resolved never to be broken by the grinding inhumanity and corruption that effectively held them for decades as political prisoners. Tonight, he'll be joined in conversation with award-winning journalist Tracy Matysak. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Albert Wood Fox and Tracy Matysak to the Free Library.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us here tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia and for joining us to talk about Albert Wood Fox's new book, Solitary. Welcome back to Philadelphia. So let's jump right in. Lots of questions, but I think the first thing is it's been 3 years and a month since your release from prison. How's your life going these days?
You're busy. other member of the political group known as Angola Three, Robert Hillary King, since I've been out, we've been on speaking engagements around the country and outside the country. Mm-hmm. And, although the principal thing we talk about is the horror and the brutality of solitary confinement, we deal with all the issues of the brutality of prisons and the way prisons are run in America. Individual and institutional racism, systemic application of racism. And so, I have four beautiful great-grandkids. And I don't want them 30, 40 years from now, one of them, to be sitting on the stage trying to start a conversation that will lead to a movement to end some of the horrors against humanity in this country and around the world. So that's my personal motivation, My philosophical motivation is I love humanity. I think we can be better as a species, and if we can be better as a species, we can build a greater society.
I want to go back and talk about your story a bit because you lay it out beautifully in the book, but I want to go back to your youth, and you were already serving a long sentence for armed robbery when you were charged with another crime that ultimately led to your being placed in solitary. I'm wondering if you can take us back to that time and tell us what were the actual circumstances that led to you being placed in what they called CCR, or solitary.
Closed cell restriction, but it's solitary confinement, which you confine to a cell, 9-by-6 cell, for 23 hours out of 24-hour period. As a young African-American male, I was the one out of four that was designated to be sent to prison. I grew up for a great deal of my life in a single parent. And like most young men, I had no hope, you know, no sense of worry, no dignity, no pride. And so I became, you know, a petty criminal. You know, I became a predator in my own community. And I preyed upon the men, women, and sometimes children who lived in my immediate neighborhood and around the city of New Orleans. One of the things that I really worried about when I realized that I was about to be free was, one, would my family still love me? And two, would my community forgive me? And I'm happy to say, you know, that both issues, I was successful. You know?
Yes to both.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was about survival for you when you were a young man.
You talk
about growing up in poverty and doing what you had to do to survive. You were in and out of prison a number of times when you were young. But talk about, if you would, you know, you get to Angola, you're there on an armed robbery sentence, 50 years. What happened and what was the crime that led to you being put in solitary?
Well, you know, by the time I got to Angola, I had joined the Black Panther Party, and I had become politically active, and my level of consciousness had been raised to understand, you know, that the things that had happened to me as a child and a young man and as an adult was not as a result of me, you know, having these qualities in me. It was a result of the kind of government and social system that I lived in. And so, you know, when I got to Angola, I remember, you know, the night before I was being sent to Angola, the guy that was in leadership of the chapter, New Orleans chapter of the Black Panther Party, and, you know, him and I sit down, and I'm like, you know, what you want me to do? You know, he said, well, you're a Panther, you know what to do. You educate, you agitate, you bring change. And so, you know, when I got to Angola, you know, when I saw something I thought was, you know, inhumane, undignified, I would speak out against it. And as a result of that, you know, I was beaten several times. I was gassed, put in the dungeon. I was forced to drink out of a toilet commode because they turned the water off. And it was in the wintertime, they turned the heat off. And, you know, I had nothing but a raggedy jumpsuit on. So, you know, but I had made a commitment to social struggle. I had developed a love for humanity. So nothing was going to break me, you know. And they, you know, they pretty much did everything they could. But they feel miserably, you know.
Yeah. And you were in solitary for a crime that you did not commit.
Yes, a correctional officer by the name of Brent Miller was found stabbed to death in a pine unit.
And that was one of the dormitories,
yeah.
Right, that was on the property of Angola.
Yeah, and at the time, you know, Harmon and I had already established a chapter of the Black Panther Party, and we were active in the prison. Angola was segregated at the time. And so we were actively, you know, fighting against corruption and security brutality. There was a thriving sex slave market going on, in which some security people benefited from directly. And so these were the kind of things, you know, we were trying to change. And we were trying to establish a dialogue between the white prisoners and black prisoners because, you know, divide and conquer is always the method that's used in prisons, you know.
Yeah.
And so we tried to show them that we had more in common than not. Mm-hmm. And that as long as we, you know, allow ourselves to be separated, then that would give the institution the more power over us and to treat us in an inhumane and undignified manner.
Yeah. So you became a Black Panther, and they had a tremendous influence on your life, but at the same time, your affiliation with the Black Panther Party created problems for you in prison.
Yeah.
Talk about
well,
that.
Well, you know, I, first of all, I was dumbfounded that the party saw enough in me, qualities of humanity in me, that they would accept me. To my knowledge, the Black Panther Party is the only political group that allowed men who were in prison to become members. Mm-hmm. You know, when I got to Angola, I went there with a purpose. I didn't go there to be good and quiet and accept what was going on there. I went there with a purpose to fight corruption, to fight brutality, to fight exploitation, prison population. And I knew that as a result of this, there would be consequences. But I had made a vow to myself and Harmon as well that we were willing to make whatever sacrifices necessary to be social activists in the prison. And even if necessary, the ultimate sacrifice, which Harmon, you know, did, he passed away 3 days after he had won his freedom from liver cancer.
Yeah. And, you know, I just want to take a moment since you brought up Herman. You and I were talking backstage about a moment that you describe in the book that was absolutely stunning. And it was, I guess, in the early 2000s, right, when Herman was in the prison hospital on his deathbed. You're there with him. They allowed you to be there. And the order comes down that his conviction is being overturned and he's to be released immediately, which should have been a wonderful thing, but then what happened next?
Well, first of all, you know, the state would never allow me and Harmon and to meet together with the lawyers. And our lawyers eventually, you know, had to go to court and get a court order, and the court ordered them to let us meet as a group, once a month, for request of our attorneys. On the day that, you know, Harmon, the liver cancer had begun to take a toll on him, and he was being held in a prison hospital. So the Department of Correction wanted to deny, you know, the visit, you know. And they were saying, well, he's unresponsive, he's, you know, in a lot of pain, blah, 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 you know. So my lawyers, you know. So I knew that they would take great pleasure in extracting as much pain out of me as thing. So when you travel, there's something called a black box. Mm-hmm. It's very painful. It locks your hand in a certain area, and you're not supposed to wear this but a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. And so I agreed to wear the black box during the whole visit.
For a long time,
yeah.
For several hours.
Yeah.
But then when the order came down and it looked like Herman was about to be set free, what did the state do in response
to
that?
Well, you know, Robin and I and two of our attorneys, Corinne Williams and Catherine Kemper, who, you know, just moderated book signing in Washington, D.C., we were sitting in the room, you know, and we knew the end was close. And so one of the lieutenants and security come in and told one of our lawyers that your law partner's on the phone. And, you know, he wanted to talk to you. And so Corinne went and she came back and, you know, she had this unbelievable smile on her face, and she walked into the room. Harmon was heavily sedated because he was in a lot of pain. And she called his name several times, and he opened his eyes, and she said, "You're a free man. You know, you're going home, you know." And you know, of course, you know, Robert, who was free, but he was there, and myself, we were elated, you know. And So we just sat there and tried to, you know, talk to him. He wasn't that responsive. Every once in a while, he would say something because he had been, sedated with powerful drugs. When the time came for me to go back, they had him in Hunts Correctional, which is at the southernmost part of the state. Mm-hmm. And they put me in a correctional facility called Wade, which is at the northernmost part.
They put you far away from each other.
To make it difficult for the Lord, to see us, since the judge, they told him they had to let us visit with our lawyers.
Yeah.
So it required me to take a six or seven-hour trip both ways from Wade to Hunts in order to meet with the lawyers.
Yeah.
And so, but
I think what really struck me about that, Mr. Woodfox, was that how you described that after he got the order that his conviction was overturned, he's supposed to be released immediately, the state reindicted him that night on his deathbed.
Before that, they were trying to delay releasing Harmon to give the state attorney
time
to go to the Fifth Circuit. They had been very successful in getting rulings in our favor overturned at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal. So when our attorney see what was happening, they immediately left and drove to Baton Rouge, which is not that long of a drive, and went to Judge Jackson and told him what was going on. And he called the prison and he said, if Harmon Wallace is not out of there within the next hour, I will have all of you in front of my bench tomorrow. And you're not going to lack what's going to be happen.
Wow.
So within an hour, we already had an ambulance there for him.
Yeah.
And so within an hour, he was released and taken to New Orleans, where,
And he passed away just a couple of days.
3 days
after
later,
that. Yeah, after he got his release. And he was in prison how long? He was in solitary?
41 years at that time.
I want to talk about your trial. You had a couple of trials, and I was struck by your description of the trials. You wrote about the exculpatory evidence that was ignored, the bloody fingerprint that didn't match any of those of you who were accused of the crime, the inmates who were rewarded for testifying against you, the witnesses who contradicted each other, contradicted themselves in many cases, the all-white juries, all of these factors. And as I read it, I had the question, why was the state so determined to pin this crime on you?
Well, I think the fact that I was a member of the Black Panther Party and the fact that I was so active, physically, active within the prison organizing against, corruption and security brutality and rape, and I dared to challenge the power structure of Louisiana State Penitentiary. So, as they say, corrupt power sees nothing, So when they found Officer Miller dead, they saw this as an opportunity to extract their revenge and by using the corrupt judicial system.
Yeah.
And I was actually the first person that they locked up for investigation of Brent Miller's murder.
Yeah.
And as you said, they had identifiable bloody fingerprint that Mr. Miller's blood, and it didn't match any of us. It didn't match any of the officers who came in and did the investigation. And that's, they just stopped after that, And the attorney general, his name, Buddy Caldwell, he actually sat down for an interview, and the journalist asked him, and he said, no, we're not concerned that. We got the men who killed Brent Miller. We don't concern, who this bloody fingerprint belongs to.
What does that tell you? What did that tell you about the justice system? The way that you're, and you had two trials. You were tried twice, convicted twice, almost tried a third time before you were released. What did that say to you about the American justice system?
I'm trying to be diplomatic, you know. America itself, as we're finding out now with the conduct and the action of the president of this country, you know, America is still a very racist country. Most, if not all, our social institutions, has a history of racism. Institutional racism makes the individual racist powerful, you know, and the systemic application of racism in this country, you know. So, you know, I think that the fact, again, you know, that I was politically conscious and that I was challenging the power structure, and this was a way they saw to send a message to all the other prisoners, you know, don't challenge us. Don't mess with us. If you do, this will happen.
You spent 40-plus years in a 6-foot by 9-foot cell. You had for 23 hours out of 24 every day. You write about being gassed repeatedly. You write about the beatings, the vicious beatings that you and other prisoners endured. Sliding food in on filthy floors, sharing your cell with vermin. Conditions that are unimaginable for most of us. And I wonder, what did you say to yourself to be able to retain your sanity through all of that? As days turn to weeks, to months, to years, to decades, what did you say to yourself to keep your sanity in that situation?
You know, well, when they first placed Harmon and I in CCR, CCR stands for closed cell restriction. It's, you know, solitary confinement. You house in a cell by yourself. You're only allowed out 1 hour out of every 24 hours. I was dedicated to social struggle. The passion and the love I had for humanity had not changed. What had happened to me, I expected. You know, I didn't think that I was going to do what I was doing in the prison and last forever. I knew at some point in time, you know, that either my life would be taken or I would be locked in solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. So I tried to do as much as I, you know, when I say I always speak in plural terms of Harmon and I. So I did as, you know, I continued to be to agitate, educate, try to raise the level of conscience of the men in prison and to try to instill in them that a sense of self-worth, that they had the worth, that they had the right to have dignity and pride, self-respect, that they were in prison. Prison was not in them, you know, and that, you know, who knows for however long they would be there. But, you know, the judge didn't sentence them to be, subhuman, or to be beaten, or to be raped, or to be have food that was meant for them to disappear, and, you know, substandard garbage served in this place. Yeah. And so, you know, it was never a question for me as to not continue to be a social activist inside Angola.
What about, though, the really dark moments? You write about, you know, weeping in your cell late at night when things had quieted down, those times when you asked yourself, is this the day I go crazy? Is this the day I lose my sanity? What kept you in those moments?
Well, I think it all started with my mom. You know, when I was coming up, my mom, through example, tried to instill in me a sense of strength, loyalty, dedication, those type of things. And unfortunately, I interpreted it as her trying to control me. And of course, you know, I rebel, you know. And there's a poem in the book called Echoes, you know, I think, in which I had grew into the wisdom and the strength that my mama was trying to instill in me. And I think that was the foundation. Being politically active gave me an opportunity to see men change before my eyes. You know, men begin to realize that they had a sense of self-worth, that they had a right to be treated in a dignified manner, and that they were not going to eat you know, food that was put on the floor and slid on the prison thing, you know. And, you know, to stop that, we actually had we went on a hunger strike for 45 days. Mm-hmm. And so as men began to, you know, pass out and stuff, we became concerned. And so we tried to find a way to end the hunger strike and change the way they fed us. So we got the security supervisors up there, and we talked with them. And we said, well, we'll eat through the bars. We're not eating underneath the floor until y'all cut some food slots. And they said, well, yeah, you know. And it was 18 months later when they finally came, cut food slots. And so for 18 months, we ate standing up, eating through the bars. Wow. Holding a tray in one hand and eating with the other hand, yeah. You know.
So you write about when the time came that you were offered a deal. You were already in solitary for over 40 years. And you write about the decision in 2016 to plead no contest.
Yes,
on no. Two charges, and in exchange for time served, which meant that you could walk away. Yeah. But you write about what a difficult decision that was for you. Even after more than 40 years in solitary confinement, you really wrestled with the decision about taking that plea deal and pleading no contest. Why was that such a difficult decision for you?
You know, all of my life, from the moment I started to serve, the first step in the journey that led to me being sitting here tonight and talking about this, I had taught men to fight back, to be strong, to not compromise on what they believed in. And so this, you know, the case had registered, you know, the judge, honorable judge named James Brady, had issued a writ, you know, that's very seldom issued, you know, and in which he overturned my conviction, ordered the state to release me immediately and forbid them from retrying me. And like always, the state ran to the Fifth Circuit. And so the Fifth Circuit overturned that ruling and said that there was enough evidence to bring me. But in reality, you know, witnesses that died, with the invent of DNA, all of a sudden all the evidence, physical evidence they had disappeared. They couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, you know, the case was in limbo. You know, and so when the offer was made, well, how the offer was made is a new attorney general had been elected, and so they didn't have the same prejudice as the previous attorney general, and they knew that it was no way they could try me. You know, so they didn't have any evidence. All the witnesses had died. The evidence that they did had exonerated me. And so, you know, they came. And I wrestled with it because, as I said, all my life, I had, you know, taught men to fight, to stand, mm-hmm. to be strong, you know. And I think what was the deciding factor for me is my daughter, you know. Mm-hmm. And my brother had told me about a conversation he had in which she had broke down and started crying, you know. And he said, you know, why are you crying? And she said, because I don't have a daddy, you know. And he said, well, you have a daddy, and I think you would be very proud of the man your daddy has become, you know. And like she said, but yeah, what does a hug feel like for my daddy, you know? What does it feel like for me to say daddy and to get a response, you know? And so that, you know, was really, you know, and I had met my grandkids and my great-grandkids. You know, and they was like asking me, you know, when I was coming home and stuff. So it was a very, very difficult. And to be honest, I still haven't come to terms with the plea deal, you know. But I am able to live with it, you know.
Take us back to that day when all the paperwork was done and you walked out of prison for the last time. What was that like?
Well, it was agonizing because the paperwork got all messed up some kind of way. And exactly two hours later, when I should have been released. And so
I mean, they had 40 years to get it right.
You know, that bitterness to the end, I guess, you know. Yeah. And, you know, the lawyers, they put so much time in this before the plea, you know, I entered the nolo contendere plea, which is the legal term.
Mm-hmm. For no contest.
And yeah, nolo contendere mean that I never pleaded guilty to killing Officer Miller. The plea was that the state had enough evidence to try me, mm-hmm. you know, and so... you know, once I, you know, accepted the plea, and they were concerned with me bringing a civil suit once I was out. So they concocted these charges that I eventually, you know, pleaded nolo contendere to.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, actually, you know, my brother Michael, who I call my rock, you know, and in 40-something years, he had never missed a month visiting, yeah. And he had, you know, done any and everything he could to make, you know, being in prison as comfortable as humanly possible.
And he was the pictures, one that came and got you that day,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, have pictures of him and I walking, and it was so strange because when I took the first step out, my knee buckle, you know, but he had me and he said, I got you, you know, don't worry, you know. And thankfully, you know, all of the A3 supporters and the press and everything, they had them down the road some from the entrance of the jail, so nobody saw, you know, that embarrassing moment for me, you know. And, you know, I had one passion, one thing in my mind. And that was to go to the graveyard and say goodbye to my mom.
You know, she passed away while you were
in
prison.
Yeah, she passed away in 94. And, you know, in black households, funerals or wakes, it gives everyone the chance to say goodbye. You know, you say goodbye in your heart, you say goodbye in your soul, because you know you're never going to, you know, hear this person laugh again or talk or whatever. And I was denied that, you know. And the same with my sister, you know. I lost her in 2002. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, I was denied the right to say goodbye. Yeah. So I had to carry those burdens for so long, you know. So when I left the prison, the first place we went to was the graveyard, you know, where my mom was buried. Yeah. And it was closed, you know. So I got out the car and I was getting ready to clam over the fence, you know. And my brother's like, no.
Not today.
Yeah, what you doing, you know? I'm like, man, I'm going to say goodbye to mama, you know? And he's like, you don't even know where the grave at, man. And, you know, you just got out of prison. You're not going back.
Don't cause any trouble today.
Yeah, so, you know, we got back in the car and we drove to the cemetery where my sister was buried at. And her husband, who was a childhood friend.
Yeah.
They both died from cancer, you know, so I was able to say goodbye to her. And the next day, you know, with as many flowers as we could buy, you know, we went and I was, you know, able to say goodbye to my mom. And I cannot tell you, you know, how wonderful it felt. It was like, you know, this unbelievable weight that had been pressing down on me, you know. Yeah. And I was so once I was able to say goodbye and tell her how much I love her.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, we are about to open up for audience questions, but before we do that, Mr. Woodfox, I would love if you would read just a short passage from your book. I think our audience would really appreciate hearing your story in your words. And I was really struck by this passage in chapter 32. It's called Maturity. And if you would read that portion that's marked off there.
I believe life is in constant motion, even in the prison cell, with a numbing repetition of the same day over and over. Even trapped on a chair with 14 other personalities, I couldn't get away from the one who is constantly complaining, the one who smells bad, even with the constant noise and when the pain of not being able to leave my cell was too much to bear. I cried a lot of times after the tear was locked down, so no one could see. Even with the fear that one day I would go insane, like so many others I've witnessed, I saw life as constantly changing, and I allowed myself to change. By the time I was 40, I saw how I had transformed myself, which was supposed to be a confined space of destruction and punishment, into something positive. I used that space to self-educate myself. I used that space to build strong moral character. I used that space to develop principles and a code of conduct. I used that space for everything other than what my captors intended it to be.
Indeed you did. Thank you so much. And we also want to acknowledge that your co-author, Leslie George, is with us tonight. There she is. She wrote the book along with Albert. And so at this point, we want to open it up for your questions. We've got some staff members with microphones, so just raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you if you have questions for Mr. Woodfox. Yes, ma'am.
Before I begin, I actually just want to let you know I'm here with my book club, which is all either current or former public defenders, and we all loved your book. It's the first one we've agreed on in a year. So I do appellate work, and in reading about your appeals process, it made me think a lot about a recent conversation I had with a client in which we had a victory of a sort, which means we have another chance. And if we win, the case goes away. And he's serving 10 to 20 years. And so I was really excited to talk to him. And in the conversation, I could hear his voice going from confused to hopeful. But I realized that as I'm telling him all these things, that his hopes may be dashed. And in reading your explanation, you talk a lot about hopes going up and down. And so I thought maybe you might have a little advice on how much to raise people's hopes, right? So I guess I just wanted your take on, is it good to give a lot of hope, meaning you might get out of jail, versus cautiously optimistic? And anyway, if you could just talk a little bit about that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, as I said, you know, I didn't go into solitary confinement as just another prisoner. Mm-hmm. I went into solitary confinement as a member of the Black Panther Party, as a man who had his level of consciousness raised to the point where he began to understand that what had happened to him and what had happened to other African-American men and other minorities and poor was not coincidental, but it was by design. And so, you know, I never lost hope. You know, no matter how dark or painful, you know, things got, I never lost hope. I always believed that I would, you know, be free one day. You know, and the strange thing about it is that when we were placed in solitary, it was April 18, 1972, the day after Mr. Miller had been found murdered, we made a solemn vow to ourselves that we would not turn away from society. That whatever moral principles or values or the way we code of conduct we had would be the influence of society and not turn inward and become what's termed as institutionalized, mm-hmm. in which you are only concerned with what's going on in the prison and you live a code of conduct, your moral principles are shaped by what's going on in prison. So although I was in prison, as Robert found, as fond of saying, prison was not in me, and I wouldn't allow it to be in me. So, you know, it was difficult, but hope springs eternal, you know. Attorneys may not be aware of it, but to every guy that's a woman or child that's in prison, you represent hope, you know. And I know sometimes the expectations are unreasonable. But that goes with being an attorney, you know. You know.
Yeah.
So, but above all, honesty. You know, don't tell your client what you think you want to hear. You know, be honest with him. Tell him just the facts as you know or as you see them, you know.
You are truly an inspiration. And as a mental health professional who has worked with people in various kinds of incarcerated states, I'm just blown away by your resilience and your strength, and anything you can tell us in addition to what you've shared already would be very, very helpful. And I'd also be curious if you'd be able to tell us what you dreamt about at night when you were incarcerated and what you dream about now.
Wow.
You dream a lot about women when you're in prison. more often than not, those dreams are erotic, you know. I guess dreams are influenced by what you may go through on any given day, on what some experience, you know. So there were times, you know, as a matter of fact, when I first began to suffer with claustrophobia, I thought it was a dream. You know, I woke up one night and I was soaking wet. My bunk was soaking wet, and the cell was about that small, mm-hmm. you know. And I couldn't move, you know. I couldn't talk, you know. I just laid there. You know, and I just kept saying to myself, this will pass, this will pass. Just all you got to do is just don't give up, you know. And I would estimate it was hours, you know, but eventually the walls began to move back and the ceiling began to move back up, you know, and I kind of like jumped up out of the bunk, you know, as though, you know, someone was physically attacking me, you know. And I just thought I was having a nightmare. You know, but as these claustrophobic attacks continue to happen, I began to realize that, you know, this was my way of dealing with being confined to this small space, you know, for 23 hours. Yeah. And so, but that's basically, you know, and what I dream about now. I still dream about women. And, you know, I dream, you know, not as much because now I'm active, you know, I'm actively involved in community organizations, and, you know, Robert and I have dedicated our life to social struggle, and I've had the privilege of coming before so many audiences like this audience. I've had the privilege to travel from one end of this country to the other. And who would have thought that one day a man from a prison cell would have something to say that a law student in Yale or Harvard or Columbia would be interested in hearing or like to find people here. And so, I missed out on my daughter growing up and my grandkids. But, you know, my great-grandkids are from age 5 to 13. So I'm so heavily invested in them, you know, and trying to be an influence in their life, you know. And, you know, my life is, you know, it's fulfilled, you know.
You're kind of living a dream in a sense these
yeah,
days,
in a way,
right?
Yeah, in yeah. a way, because, you know, when we were in prison, we noticed that with all the, you know, the 60s and the 70s, 70s were times up. He was social, civil rights movements were at the height. But the men and women in prison, hidden behind, especially those in solitary, hidden behind the walls of prison, had no voice. Yeah. And nobody knew what we looked like. So we always made this vow that, you know, when we went free, we would be that voice. And we would be that face. We would make mothers remember that their sons are in prison, and fathers remember that their sons or daughters are in prison, grandparents, you know, that men and women and children who are held in prison, they do not come from another planet. They come from your family, you know, and so it is tantamount that you love and support them, mm-hmm. not in the best of times, but especially in the worst of times, you know. Mm-hmm. And the reason prisoners are able to do what they do to your relatives is no one cares. You know, it's sad to say that I was extremely lucky. You know, people ask me, you know, how you did it, you know, and I have no idea. I just knew that never, other than losing my mind, were there a moment where I was, had given up hope, had my spirits broken, or that I was not willing to make sacrifice for what I believed in, you know.
Peace, comrade. I was wondering, you were opened your talk talking about building a mass movement and how important that was to you. And I was thinking about, in light of the Jailhouse Lawyers Speak down in South Carolina, organizing the largest prison strike in the history of the country last August, last Black August. I was hoping you could shed some light on what building a mass movement would mean, specifically for the prison class. And thinking more about George Jackson saying that when the prison gates fly open, the real dragon will fly out. I was hoping you could tell me how you think the real dragon will fly out.
I have no idea. I just hope that, you know, men and women who are in prison, and if they're lucky enough to gain their freedom, that they will follow the example I'm trying to set. You know, a lot of people think that I'm not angry. I'm very angry, you know. You know, you can't take 44 years and 10 months of my life and lock me in a cell and try to break my spirit, treat me as though I'm an animal, and I don't be angry. But I define who I am. I define the kind of human being I am, the type of man I want. And I hope that men and women who are lucky enough to get out of prison can find that within themselves. You know, as I say in the book from the chapter I read, you know, a cell that was meant to be a death chamber, I turned it into a classroom, you know. A cell that was meant to strip me of human dignity and pride and self-respect, I built human dignity and pride and self-respect. And so my greatest revenge against those who tried to destroy me as a human being is to be here sitting in an auditorium with men, women, and, who are, you know, socially conscious and trying to use what I went through as an example and an inspiration. That is my way. That is where my anger is directed toward. And I hope, you know, the ancestors will allow, give me at least 30, 40 more years to do that, you know.
Yes, indeed.
Hi, Albert. It's so nice to see you here. I remember reading years ago about Angola, and one thing that struck me was I remember reading that something like 80 to 90% of the prisoners don't make it out alive. Do you know that figure to be correct?
Well, I don't know the exact percentage, but, you know, I can tell you this. The average person that go to Angola will spend 30, 40 years, 50 years in there before they release. Some die, you know, in Angola from, you know, just being old age and stuff, you know. But I think that there is a movement in the country now for prison reform. Mm-hmm. And there has been some rulings that came from the previous Supreme Court. And so a lot of guys, what we call old-timers, you know, have been locked down 30, 40 years or beginning to get out, you know. And There is a devious reason for this. You know, when you go to prison and you're young and healthy and they can work you from sun up to sun down, you represent profit, you know. Yeah. But when you get older and your body starts to change and you develop certain illnesses, you become a burden upon the budget, you know. So I don't think it is a moral principle about letting guys out of prison. I think it's an economic decision. You know, they want to get these older guys off their budget so that they can bring younger guys in and make profit, especially now with the advent of the prison industrial complex.
Yeah.
You know, prison, private prisons now have become a very profitable business to the point the way they're trading on Wall Street now.
Thank you for tonight. Just unbelievable. But I wanted to ask you, what was the biggest surprise coming out in today's America from when you went in and 40 years ago? I mean, I assume you didn't have a cell phone or anything magical like that. What really struck you about life in America today?
That there was no real change. You know, when I left society in 1969, the racism in this country was brutal, in your face. And when I was released from prison in 2016, then I realized that racism had put on a tie and a suit, you know. And there are many ways, and I'll use this word just for description. There are many ways to call me a nigger, other than using that word. And I realized that, you know, that this country had only, you know, and you know, the fact that the president, we have the kind of president we have now, validified my analysis of what was going on in this country. So there was no real change. You know.
I just want to say thank you for being here. I feel like my generation has really messed up because we really stand in line waiting for Marvel movies when you're the real superhero. Like, I just feel like you're the real superhero. A lot of us, when we read this book, we kind of like detach ourselves thinking that, oh, this is Louisiana. We're not the South. This is Pennsylvania. But I just want to give like recognition now to Mumia Abdul-Jabbar. And I just want to say that, have you had the opportunity to meet with him while you're in Philadelphia now? And how did that discussion go? And what would you say to other people who are wrongfully convicted, who are in solitary confinement and in death row right now? Thank you.
Fight. I mean, you know.
You mentioned Mumia in the book, I believe.
Mumia?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm 100% supporter, you know, and we are friends. I have had an opportunity to talk with him on the phone, and I will support him in any way possible, and hopefully one day he will be sitting here, you know, talking to men, women, and children, trying to inspire them, you know. As far as, you know, there's no place, no city or state in this country where you can go that racism don't exist, you know. So stand, fight, you know. There are more men and women now who feel and think the way you do than you may be aware of. But you can find those people. You can work, you know. An individual can cause chaos. Mass movements can cause change, you know. So, you know, you can't do it by yourself. That's the first thing you have to realize, you know. And one thing more, I try not to personalize social struggle, you know. I try to be objective about it as I can. And I try to see what I'm trying to do. You know, I'm trying to create a dialogue that I hope will lead to a movement, not just, you know, in America, but around the world, because America has such tremendous influence on other countries in the world. So, you know, when we go to, you know, I've been to, you know, England, Paris, Belgium, Germany, you know, and we have spoken about this, and I've spoken to, you know, politicians and legislators and stuff, and they ask me, you know, what advice do I have? And I always say, when it comes to social issues, don't allow what happens in America to be an influence in your country, especially in your prison system, you know, because if you do, the problems that citizens in America are having now, you will have in your country, you know.
Hi. Again, I want to thank you for letting us talk to you and hear your story. I just want to say that I'm with a group called the Human Rights Coalition, and what we do is fight for the men and women in solitary confinement. And last year, we had a bill introduced to basically end or change solitary confinement to not more than 15 days. The hard part is getting people on board with that bill. Like you said earlier, a lot of people don't care. They don't see it. They don't have a face. They don't care. Do you have any suggestions on how we can get this message out more and get a face on it? Anything you can give us would be helpful. Thank you.
Well, you know, there are social organizations out there that are fighting the same battle that you are fighting. I would suggest that you really can find information on how to contact these organizations or start your own community organization. You know, and there is no easy answer or no easy solution. You have, you know, I think the reasons that prisons are able to do the things they do is because there is no community oversight. There's no one. So, you know, you have to demand. It starts with the people that you elect to represent you. And a lot of time we elect politicians because of one issue that we agree with. And then when these politicians get in elected office and they go from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde, you know, we like, I didn't vote for that, but yes, you did vote for that, you know. You voted for that, you just didn't pay enough attention or you didn't show enough interest to see what else this person believe in, you know. And so that's where it starts, you know, in a democratic society, which we are not right now, you know. The electoral process is probably if you get a chance to vote against the electoral college, please do. Yeah.
Well, on that advice, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be starting the book signing in just a few minutes, but please join me once again in thanking Albert Woodfox for being here, and thanks to all of you for coming out tonight.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.